Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage's completely online process lets you get a custom mortgage solution wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The story of African Americans is one of slavery, Jim Crow, police shootings, but also of perseverance and great accomplishments. Of protests and of the first black president, African Americans have not had a home of their own on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. until now. This weekend, the National Museum of African American History and Culture opens. This hour on Point, a look inside the museum and our country's ongoing struggles with race. You can join us on air or online. What do you hope to see in a museum of African American history and culture? As protests continue in Charlotte, what can we learn from the historical struggle of blacks in America? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Before we turn to the new Smithsonian Museum of African American History and Culture, we can't ignore the news out of Charlotte, North Carolina. A black man shot and killed by police on Tuesday. Two nights of protests. Joining me now from Charlotte, North Carolina, with all the details is Javed Kalim, national race and justice reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Javed, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane.
So a second night of violent protests in Charlotte. What's the latest on the ground there?
Well, this morning is quite a different scene from last night. Last night we had a shooting with a man who was critically injured and in the hospital. At least four police officers with minor injuries and two other people who were protesters with minor injuries. Buildings with windows smashed and some street fights. I saw some blood on the streets. By this morning, it's all quiet in downtown Charlotte. Cleaning crews are out, volunteers are out. Several businesses have closed, like Bank of America, which is headquartered here, and telling employees to stay home today.
Here is some sound from the streets of Charlotte, North Carolina, last night as police shot tear gas and rubber bullets into the crowd. Street clashes there, Javed, became increasingly desperate and violent. A state of emergency declared as well.
Yes, state of emergency declared, and the National Guard has been moving its trucks out of its headquarters, its armory here, and we're actually waiting in just maybe 20 minutes or so, the police chief and the mayor are supposed to speak at a press conference where I imagine we might hear more about a possible curfew, about the National Guard, as well as there's been talk of the video of the shooting of Keith Lamont Scott on Tuesday and if that'll be released.
So talk to us about the shooting of Keith Lamont Scott, fatally shot Tuesday. Was he armed? What do we know?
There's two sides to that story, you talk to the family, his wife and his daughter, as well as people in that community where he was shot, who say they saw it happen, and they say he wasn't armed, and they say he was a disabled man who was innocent, who was reading a book in his car, who was waiting for his son to get off the school bus coming home from elementary school. And that he was targeted by police. Police say that they showed up to this apartment complex northeast of downtown Charlotte looking for a different suspect with an outstanding warrant, but happened upon Mr. Scott, who had a gun and who was in his car and would not got out of his car with his gun, and police felt threatened and shot him. They say he didn't have a book, and that he, they describe him very differently than others who are not police do. Police say it was a black officer who shot Scott. People in the community believe it was a white officer.
Here's some sound from the Charlotte-Mecklenburg police chief, Kerry Putney, saying in a press conference on Wednesday that they found a gun on the scene of the shooting death of Keith Lamont Scott.
We did not find a book that has been made reference to. We did find a weapon, and the weapon was there, and the witnesses corroborated it too, beyond just the officers.
And here's Keith Scott's sister telling reporters that Scott did not have a gun, that he was just reading and waiting for his children when police shot him.
He didn't have no gun. He wasn't messing with nobody. All they did, them jump out boys, them undercover detectives, they jumped out their truck. They said, hands up. He got a gun. He got a gun. Pow, 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 pow. That's it.
So, Javed, these are obviously two very different stories, two very conflicting stories.
They are. And the conflict isn't just about, you know, what happened at the shooting. You talk to people out here who are protesting, and they have different stories, too. You know, one man was shot last night, and police say it was a civilian-on-civilian shooting, pretty much meaning it was somebody who was protesting, who shot somebody who was protesting. But then you talk to protesters, and they say, no, we saw a police officer shoot a gun and hit somebody who almost died.
The police officer who shot and killed Scott is named Brentley Vinson. What do we know about him?
He's been on the police force for 2 years, so he doesn't have a long history with the Charlotte area police. He is a black officer, and you know, details are slim on his background. He's currently on leave, which is routine in police shootings here and elsewhere.
And was he wearing a body camera or not? Is there dashboard video or not? And will any of that footage be released?
Yes. He was not wearing a body camera. He was not in full uniform. He was in plain clothes with a vest that had a police logo on it, so he didn't have the police uniform that you could typically have attach a body camera to. But other officers who were in uniform were with him, and it sounds like, you know, there's been some conflicting or changing stories from officials that they had body cameras possibly, and that there was possibly dash cam video. Initially, the police chief said that he wasn't sure if the video showed Scott actually, you know, raising his gun toward police or pointing it toward police. So he wasn't sure if that was, you know, there's a direct threat per se in that way. It's still unclear if the video will be released. The Charlotte mayor this morning said that she planned to show the video to family, which is usually the first step after a police shooting, show to family and then release to the public.
Here's another piece of sound. This is live on camera last night in the middle of the Charlotte protests. CNN reporter Ed Lavandera was assaulted when a protester knocked him to the ground. Here is that moment in the voice of anchor Anderson Cooper in the background.
As other people came in to try to grab those people.
Murder! 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 Murder!
Ed, are you okay?
Yeah, we're fine, Anderson, we're fine. So just someone taking out their frustrations on me. But, right.
So if you need to leave that location, Ed, that's fine.
So, of course, these protests in Charlotte, all the unrest there in North Carolina comes after two other deadly shootings by police in the last week. In Columbus, Ohio, a teenager was shot after brandishing a BB gun. Javed, what are the circumstances surrounding that case?
Yes, he was 13 years old, and a caller called 911 to report a robbery of $10 from a man in the street by three people, including reportedly this young 13-year-old boy. And he was chased into an alley by police with another accomplice, who was later arrested, and after... police say he showed his BB gun from his waistband, which they say they thought was an actual gun. They shot him, and he died. It's kind of been overshadowed, one after the other. You know, the shooting in Columbus, Ohio, by the one in Tulsa, by the one now in Charlotte. But the latest in Ohio, you know, it's still pending. It really hasn't been that long, but the family is contesting the police version of events. They have asked for an independent investigation, independent autopsy, and they want to know what happened to their son.
So then 2 days later, in Tulsa, the shooting death of Terrence Crutcher, who had both hands, reportedly, above his head before he was shot. Was he unarmed? What happened there?
Yes, he was unarmed. Unlike here in Charlotte, in Tulsa, the story is much more clear about what happened. The police, due to pressure, quickly released several videos of the shooting of Terrence Crutcher that show him with his hands up, walking toward his broken-down truck in the middle of the road after callers reported a suspicious car and person. And, being pretty much shot by police as he's lowering his hands toward his car. Now, these videos all show this, and they're pretty clear. Police also say he had no weapon. They recovered no weapon, although the officer who shot him has said through a lawyer that she thought he had a weapon, thought he was reaching into his car. Now, his family's lawyers say, no, the car window is up. We have photo evidence of that. And also, this officer who shot him, a white female officer, through her lawyer, has said she was it was one of the scariest situations she's been in her life, that she was fearful for her life, and that she didn't even notice that there were other officers with her. She said she had tunnel vision and didn't notice that another officer was tasing Crutcher at the same time.
Tulsa, Columbus, Charlotte. We will keep watching this. Javed Khalim, national race and justice reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Thank you so much for being with us from Charlotte. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. More after this break. This is On Point. We're looking at the new Museum of African American History and Culture that opens this weekend in Washington now, and you can join the conversation. How can we better understand United States history, racial tensions today, through the experience of African Americans? Have you bought your ticket to the museum? What are you hoping to come away with? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Judge Robert Wilkins, a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. District. He's the author of Long Road to Hard Truth, the 100-year mission to create the National Museum of African American History and Culture. For an excerpt, you can go to our website, onpointradio.org. Judge Wilkins, great to have you. Welcome to On Point.
Jane, thank you so much.
Thank
Lovely
you.
To be here.
And from New York, Vincent Cunningham joins us, staff writer for The New Yorker. His recent piece on the museum is Making a Home for Black History, the vision and challenges behind the new museum on the National Mall. You can find a link on our website. Vincent Cunningham, welcome to you.
Jane, it's wonderful to be with you. Thank you so much.
Judge Wilkins, we just heard from Javed Khalid about the most recent police shootings in this country and the protests that have erupted because of it. I want to ask you about the timing of the opening of this extraordinary museum amidst so much discord and unrest and questions about policing in minority communities in this country.
Well, it is an amazing time for the museum to open, and ironically, it's going to open at the end of President Obama's tenure as the first African-American president of the United States. And with all this discussion going on, to some degree, it's like history repeating itself, because over the 100-year venture that has taken this museum to come to being, we had the Kerner Commission report and riots in Chicago in 1919 and all of those various things that have accompanied the history of this museum.
The director of the Smithsonian's new museum, Lonnie Bunch, said that this new museum is not a story of tragedy, but rather one with hope. Here he is.
The African-American experience is an experience not of tragedy, but of unbelievable belief in themselves, belief in an America that often didn't believe in them.
In fact, Vincent Cunningham, the founding of this museum goes back to 1915 when a group of African-American veterans proposed a museum in Washington. What were the major stops and starts in creating this museum?
Well, I know that Judge Wilkins knows the history much better than I do, given his the authorship of his book. But yeah, that time at the beginning in 1915, when the 50th anniversary of the Civil War, black Union soldiers faced a lot of persecution there in Washington, even at a time that should have been celebratory of their efforts, and thus began this this 100-year journey. And lots of stops and starts. Herbert Hoover appointed a commission that included such luminaries as Mary McLeod Bethune, but that was totally underfunded and or unfunded, that is, and never sort of got off the ground. And so it's been a long way until now. And Judge Wilkins and others sort of picked up the effort toward the end of the 20th century, and here we are. It is in some ways a triumph of democracy at the same time as it does relay some of the tragedy of delay. So it's a mixed story, but obviously a triumphant one starting this weekend. Mm.
Judge Wilkins, when planning this museum, how did you decide where the story of African Americans begins?
Well, I think that it's important to have the full context. And so the commission that I was on that planning this wanted to, you know, we talked to people around the country. And the consensus was among, you know, your general citizen as well as among the scholars is that, you know, the story should begin in Africa and trace the diaspora and the immigration, forced immigration of Africans here to this country and go from there. And it is somewhat of a bleak beginning, but I think that part of the beauty of this museum is that the full context is that that's not where the story ends.
So describe for us then, Judge Wilkins, what you see when you first enter the museum in the lowest concourse, deep in the basement levels.
Well, it's really striking because it begins with an explanation of what slavery was like back in, you know, around the world in the, you know, 1400s and how it evolved from, you know, being a temporary status and not really based on race to a status that, you know, was a lifelong status that was passed on from generation to generation and was based on race and then justified by racism and racist ideology. And it goes on from there to describe how that institution really helped to build America.
Mm. Vincent Cunningham, how, to your mind, does the museum address the horrors of slavery?
I think it's the name of that exhibition, if I'm correct, is Slavery and Freedom, which kind of speaks to this ongoing dialectic in America between those two ideas, right? In America, even the idea of freedom depends on the kind of awareness of the underbelly of slavery. So, you know, along a great big wall, there are these quotes from kind of promissory texts, you know, texts beginning with the Declaration of Independence that kind of speak to the ideal of freedom, which, of course, is not reflected in the institution of slavery. And so there are very many, you know, affecting artifacts. You know, one, the sort of greatest one for me was this cabin that's from the Point of Pines plantation in South Carolina that was a real, you know, a slave cabin. And the kind of understanding of how this horror was made to have this core of normalcy, you know, a place where you would have, you know, kind of lived out your life amid this this crazy institution. It's incredibly affecting. I think that you know, we talked earlier in your segment earlier about the sort of things that are still going on now in Oklahoma and beyond. I think the challenge for the museum will be how to sort of take those artifacts and interpret them, you know, all through the history and interpret them in a way that helps us, you know, move forward because the black story in many ways has been a story of tactics, political and otherwise. Mm. And so that'll be something to look forward to.
So you mentioned the remnants. It is incredible. Remnants of a slave ship, rusted shackles, an auction block. I'm looking at preview pictures here, the type of whip that was used on slave ships. It is incredibly affecting, incredibly moving, Judge Wilkins. Talk about the challenge of interpreting those artifacts and what you want people to understand from that period in American history.
Well, I think it's a delicate balance that this museum has to strike. I think that the museum needs to have people really feel the pain and the horror and understand the evilness of the institution and the perniciousness of how people were treated and just the humanity was denied and ignored and suppressed. But I think that we can't allow that to completely overwhelm the visitor. And so I think that the museum tries to place this all in context without it becoming, such a depressing place. But it's hard. When I was there for the preview on this past Saturday evening, I spoke to a gentleman as we were walking out of that gallery, and he said, this is depressing down here. And I said to him, and he's an African-American gentleman, probably in his mid to late 60s, and I said, it is. But I pointed to a photograph of some sharecroppers, some black sharecroppers, and said, but think about if you could go back in time and tell, that gentleman there that, in this day and age there would be a museum and it was going to be opened by, a black president. What, do you think he would have a smile on his face when you told him that? So, maybe that's too Pollyannish, but I think that, the flip side of the coin of tragedy is what happened to overcome that tragedy, and we have done a lot of overcoming.
Let's get some callers in here. Justin, first from New Orleans, Louisiana. Justin, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Oh, hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I just wanted to really point out that I think when discussing the narrative of black history in this country, the very first mention of blacks in this country should be with indentured servitude, because actually the very first workers brought in to work the fields, primarily tobacco fields in Virginia and the Chesapeake colonies, were whites. They were indentured servants. Okay. Then later on they brought in blacks from Africa that were not slaves. They served their period of indentured servitude and then they were free. Then, as more they begin to bring more black indentured servitude servants in, the institution of slavery in America began to take hold. But that was later.
Justin, thank you. Vincent Cunningham, would you speak to that and some history there?
Oh well, I'm sure that there is a a varied, an incredibly varied history of black people, as Judge Wilkins mentioned, the sort of diaspora of black people in this country beginning in the beginning of the 17th century. Some were free, some were not. But, of course, again, interpretation matters here, and it needs to be mentioned that this country was built on the institution of slavery. Not just indentured servitude, and not. Of course, there were many ways in which a black person in this country first experienced this country, but nations have founding myths and founding understandings of how we got to this point, and so we can't paper over or try to sort of cut the bite. The sting of slavery, because it is so important.
Here's an interview with Lonnie Bunch again with CBS. He's the director of the National Museum of African American History and Culture, saying it was not easy to determine which theme the museum should adopt.
We spent 2 years going around the country talking to people, just finding out what they knew, what they didn't know. And then I brought the best scholars in and said, okay, tell us what you think. And then I told everybody, go away. And we sat down and we said, this is the story we want. We want to find the tension between resiliency and tragedy.
Judge Wilkins, that tension between resiliency and tragedy, I mean, you can hear it in this conversation. You can read about it. You can certainly see it. The museum tells the African-American story chronologically rather than thematically. So as you leave that first concourse level, then what is next? Where do you move to?
Well, as you move up and out of the slavery experience and you're coming through Jim Crow and then into the civil rights movement and beyond, you come to the culture and community galleries where you really start to – it's still – you're experiencing history, but you're experiencing it more through the lens of the various cultural accomplishments and themes of the African-American experience, from clothing to dance to music to sports and to the fine arts, of course. And so it's the I think the more the full experience and the breadth and the triumph of African-American history and culture.
Vincent Cunningham, there were more than 35,000 artifacts that were collected from all over the world for this museum. Tell me some of them and what you were most impressed by.
Well, kind of piggybacking on Judge Wilkins' point, I was so impressed with some of the things in the culture galleries because as we talked before about how to interpret historical items, of course, the artist does this as a matter of course. This is the process of art, to take social and historical materials and take them through this kind of refining process of interpretation. So one thing that I loved in the fine art gallery, which I think is really kind of one of the jewels of the museum, is a painting by Sam Gilliam, which he painted in commemoration of the death of Martin Luther King, and it's this kind of smudged, kind of moody background with this splattering of red, of course, to denote that terrible tragedy. And it just it talks so directly to the sort of beauty, again, this tension between the beauty and the tragedy of experience, and what wonderful creativity and contribution has come from it over the years.
I'm looking at some pictures here, some preview pictures of the museum, of the exhibit. Harriet Tubman's shawl and hymnal from the 1800s. Nat Turner's Bible, of course. Nat Turner led a slave rebellion in 1831, which spurred harsher laws against slaves and blacks. I mean, Frederick Douglass's items from his life, and Abraham Lincoln's inkwell. I mean, it just goes on and on. Judge Wilkins, what do you see in this? What are your favorite memories, moments, artifacts?
Well, I was also struck by the slave cabin that Vincent mentioned, and in fact, I was so struck by it that I put it on the cover of my book. I think it's a great contrast to, you know, the structure of the museum itself, which is such a beautiful edifice and just an engaging design. You know, I really enjoyed, you know, the music gallery as a music fan, and just seeing the joy and the pain, you know, expressed through the musicians and the artists, and seeing that reflected in the gallery and people, you know, enjoying everything from, you know, the exhibits from the Soul Train television show to, you know, the pain expressed by artists like Marvin Gaye and others. It was just really pretty amazing.
Judge Robert Wilkins and Vincent Cunningham from The New Yorker, please stick with us. We're discussing the Smithsonian's new National Museum of African American History and Culture opening in Washington, D.C. on the Mall. Behind us, Chuck Berry's Maybelline. At the museum, you can see the guitar Berry used to write this song. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. More after this break. This is On Point.
Back doing the thing you used to do.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings home financing into the 21st century with a completely online process that's fast, easy, and convenient. Using a phone or tablet, you can safely share bank statements and pay stubs without having to dig through piles of paperwork. It takes just a few minutes to get a custom mortgage solution on your terms, wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org number 3030.
We're going to be all right. We're going to be all right. We're going to be all right. Do you hear me? Do you feel me? We're going to be all right.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're discussing the Smithsonian's new National Museum of African American History and Culture. Behind us there was Kendrick Lamar's All Right, the official anthem to the Black Lives Matters movement. And you can join the conversation here. How should the National Museum of African American History and Culture take on the current news? Can the museum help facilitate a conversation about race in America? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook. With me, a terrific panel, Judge Robert Wilkins, a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. He's the author of Long Road to Hard Truth, the 100-year mission to create the National Museum of African American History and Culture, and Vincent Cunningham, staff writer for The New Yorker. Here is the director of the new museum, again, Lonnie Bunch, telling The Washington Post that the museum will also build archives on current African American issues, including Black Lives Matter.
We realized that Black Lives Matter was both really important, something that should be in the museum. We've collected some of the digital material, the photographs, the videos that were taken. But we also wanted to make sure that we had the material so that a curator or a director can, 10 years from now or 15 years from now, tell the story in greater detail than we can.
Vincent Cunningham, how does the museum handle more modern history, like the Black Lives Matter movement?
Yeah, there's a section of the museum that ranges from 68, the assassination of King, to the present. And, of course, that includes the historic election of Barack Obama and items, as Lonnie Bunch mentions, from the Black Lives Matter movement. Of course, this isn't – it couldn't ever be in as great a detail as slavery and other things like this. But I think it's one of the more intriguing things about the museum. It's – of course, the present is becoming the past every second, and – there is a bit of art to figuring out what it is about the present that will be history later on, you know, capital H history. So that sort of intuition as we go forward, I think, is really interesting. And I think it'll be something to watch happen.
Let's get Molly in here from New Orleans, Louisiana. Molly, thanks for waiting. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. I had a comment and a question for the guests. First, I just wanted to respond quickly to the commenter who brought up indentured servitude in the early colonies, because this factoid seems to be frequently trotted out in contexts such as this one in discussions of American slavery. And it's upsetting when that happens, because whether intended by the caller or not, it minimizes the magnitude and centrality of slavery to American history. You know, indentured servitude wasn't written into our Constitution via the Fugitive Slave Law and the Three-Fifths Clause. You know, our first great infusions of wealth and prosperity in both the North and the South weren't built on the backs of indentured servants. They were built on the backs of slaves. Mm-hmm. We didn't fight a civil war over indentured servitude. Mm-hmm. We didn't create a legalized system of segregation based on the legacy of servitude.
Yep. Yep.
So to compare that is, it's not really a comparison. It's an insult.
Molly, thank
and,
you.
And my question is connecting this discussion to the previous segment on the shootings of unarmed Black men in Tulsa and elsewhere. I'm wondering whether the museum has any ideas for educational outreach or even legislation to try to get this much-needed history that's been missing from our classrooms, from our society, to get that into the world. Or is the museum just a good enough starting place?
Molly, thank you. Judge Wilkins.
Well, the museum is intended to really, I think that they've set things up to try to have a conversation with other institutions around the country. You know, they've created exhibits that will maybe begin here in Washington and travel around to other places. There's a grant program that's been set up so that professionals from other museums can can get grant funding and training in conjunction with this museum. And, you know, they've got a very robust website and digital facilities to try to, you know, create educational materials for students around the country. I'm sure there's always more that can be done. I don't know everything that's happening, but I know that they're cognizant of that issue.
Let's go to Mary in Charlottesville, Virginia. Hi, Mary. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Of course.
Thanks to your panel. I'm mixed. Literally, half my family is black, half is white. And I think the focus on slavery and that part of the diaspora does a disservice to the African-American part of my family, because my ancestor came here from the West Indies, and he was an extremely wealthy landowner. And he and the people that he brought with him were never slaves. And I think it would also be helpful to let every African-American in this country know, whether or not they know their genealogy, that, you know, they could have come from wealthy, free people.
Mary, thank you. I'm going to jump in because of time, but Judge Wilkins, respond to that. I mean, there's so much more to the museum than the slavery exhibition, which is an important part.
Yes. I mean, the museum doesn't say that, you know, all African Americans descended from slaves, and it talks about free communities of color and how they lived, and others who immigrated in other ways other than through the Middle Passage. So don't misunderstand that fact.
I've read actually many articles that the museum's creators did not want to build a museum for a black audience alone, but for all Americans. And to that end, you ran a project in 15 cities. Vincent Cunningham, speak to this, encouraging ordinary people to give heirlooms from their closets, from their attics. I'm curious the reaction of the people that gave, and what were some of the surprises from that collection?
Sure. I talked about that with Lonnie Bunch when we sat down and talked, and it was kind of an antiques roadshow kind of experience is what he likened it to, you know, people having old things from their grandparents and great-grandparents that they didn't know whether they were sort of historically relevant. And so they sort of, a lot of curators and conservationists from the museum, people that could help people preserve paper or different kinds of textiles and fabrics, and either help them to keep them themselves or give them to local history museums and historical societies. And in certain exceptional cases, these things make their way into the museum. I think there was a Big Joe Turner's suit or something like that came through this channel. There's, you know, a lot of the, especially clothing, because, you know, there's this kind of very literal way in which this history kind of hides in back rooms and closets. Mm. And so it's a wonderful literalization of kind of the museum's mission.
Yeah. Speaking of clothing, other items include Rosa Parks' dress, the one she was making the day she was arrested in 1955. Other items, there's the whites-only door from San Antonio, Texas in the 1950s. There's a segregated rail car in there, which shows the different accommodations for white and black passengers who paid the same fare. There's a wall I read about that I think describes the Tuskegee syphilis experiment. I mean, there's so much in there. The casket of Emmett Till, who was beaten and killed when he was 14 for allegedly flirting with a young white woman. Judge Wilkins, what's the takeaway from some of these artifacts that came from ordinary people and those that are there more significant, perhaps?
I mean, I think that there are so many profound stories. I mean, one artifact that was just really amazing to me that was donated to the museum were freedom papers from a man who I believe had purchased his freedom, and he had constructed this tin container that he preserved them in. And of course, those papers were vitally important to him because they were the proof that he was a free man in the 1800s. And just to think about, you know, everything that that person went through to gain his freedom, to save up the money to gain his freedom, and I think he had purchased his wife's freedom as well, and just to have to carry this tin around and safeguard it, because that was his freedom. There's just so many poignant and important, you know, things to take away from all of these various exhibits. I think resiliency is what I would say.
Let's get Bruce in here from Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Bruce. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thanks very much.
Yes.
I've been interested in studying African-American Medal of Honor winners during World War II, and they were not actually awarded the Medal of Honor for their World War II service until 1997, when President Clinton gave the medal to the single survivor, Vernon Baker, from that period, and then to widows and other family members of other Black Medal of Honor winners. During World War II, they were only awarded the Distinguished Service Cross, and that lack of justice was only, you know, rectified later on in 1997, and there's great film footage on that. But anyway, that's led me to study World War II very carefully and quite intensely, the African-American experience in particular. And what you come away with to a significant extent is the hopefulness of soldiers going in, that if you sacrifice your life against fascism, which is a racist ideology, that the American public would honor you and accept you fully integrated. And just this despair that so many African-Americans dropped into when they constantly confronted segregation, both at home and a segregated army. So I was just wondering how maybe the exhibit, whether or not it touches upon the Medal of Honor winners, the Black Medal of Honor winners, which is a remarkable story, and also that tension that was earlier talked about between this hopefulness of African-Americans and the despair that they suffered as a result of the segregation and discrimination that remained in World War II and afterwards.
Bruce, thank you so much for the call. Vincent Cunningham, what about the Medal of Honor winners that were African-American?
You know, I'm not sure whether the museum documents that specific history of those Medal of Honor winners, but I do know that there is a section about Blacks in the military generally, and there are certain, you know, their uniforms and things like this. And of course, Black people have fought in every one of our wars, you know, including starting with the Civil War. So that, of course, that's an incredible part of the history. I think that's one of the challenges of a museum that would collect, you know, things about African-American history writ large, just because Black people, of course, have contributed to every part of our history. So there's a big challenge there.
Vincent, you wrote in The New Yorker, actually you quote Eric Foner from his anthology, America's Black Past. He wrote that one of our country's myths and misconceptions is the picture of Blacks as inactive agents in history. I'm curious, does this museum give them a more active role in history?
Absolutely. I think that there's no way to even begin to scratch the surface of the history of Black Americans without coming away with a view different than that. But as Eric Foner wrote then, and as persists to this day, I think that there is often a portrayal of history that says, oh, and Black people were there too in X or Y way. But this one of the great things about this museum is that sense of agency and that sense of sort of prime movership of so much of our history.
Judge Wilkins, does the museum right a wrong? Should it?
I think it does. It's part memorial as well as museum. I think that it serves as a tribute to African American contributions to this nation, a way to remember the suffering of so many people whose names we'll never know and faces we'll never see, while we also learn something and learn about how to move forward.
Let's get Laval here from New Orleans, Louisiana. You're on the air. Laval, welcome to the program.
Hello, Jane, and to your guests. I want to commend Molly from New Orleans, who called from New Orleans, for counterpointing Justin, who called from New Orleans. I'm from New Orleans, born and raised here, lived all over the country. But I want to say something. New Orleans was ground zero for the slave trade as far as the ship,
the
port. And I think that gets lost a lot of times. And even today, there's still vestiges of slavery in New Orleans. I mean, the Mardi Gras crews were forced by law maybe 25 years ago to integrate because they didn't allow blacks, women, and Jews. Some of them did not. So, you know, New Orleans is a very pain-stricken city. And even the images of from Katrina, to me, just sort of reminded me of the vestiges of slavery. Yeah. It's pretty egregious when you really look at it on its face.
Laval, thank you so much for the call. I'm going to jump in for time's sake because I want to get to this last point. Tens of thousands of people will attend the opening of this museum, Judge Wilkins, on Saturday, I believe. Tickets are free. Tell us who will be there. What do you expect?
Well, you know, it's going to be amazing. You know, President Obama, of course, will speak. The founding director, Lonnie Bunch, will speak. I believe that Wynton Marsalis has composed an original piece of music for the opening. I'm sure that President Bush and former First Lady Laura Bush will be there with his role in signing the legislation, and Mrs. Bush is on the advisory council for the museum. So it's going to be, you know, a great day. There's going to be a music. Public Enemy is performing, and so it's going to be a fun time.
And President Obama will ring a 500-pound bell. I read from a church founded by slaves in 1776. Sure to be quite a memory. Judge Robert Wilkins from the U.S. Court of Appeals on the D.C. Circuit, I appreciate so much you coming in and giving us a preview of what to expect at the museum. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much for having me, Jane.
And Vincent Cunningham, staff writer for The New Yorker. Vincent, thank you very much.
Such a pleasure to be with you. Thank you so much.
You can continue the conversation. Listeners, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, Week in the News. Tom's back for that. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.